Cold War echoes in eastern Ukraine today, Wednesday, April 16th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Russia is accused of trying to build a new Berlin Wall in eastern Ukraine, where pro-Russia gunmen have occupied, if not technically seized, a key city building in Donetsk.
The city council is allowed to meet, but obviously anytime that you have men with ski masks on the first floor, that's not a normal work day.
Also, we'll hear an old Ukrainian folk song that's taken on a new meaning during the crisis. Plus what it was like to celebrate Passover in the old Soviet Union when baking matzah was illegal.
It was like a sense of secrecy around this, and it was feeling some pride in your heart. You know, you're doing something secretly what the government doesn't want.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, searching for runners who benefit from medical technology to run in the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon or Medtronic 10-Mile Run. Application and information available at medtronic.com/globalheroes.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. No one says they want war in Ukraine, but just look on the ground, in the country's east especially, and tensions keep rising. Ukrainian troops have been deployed in the east to recapture areas seized by pro-Russia separatists, but in one town they were blocked by civilians and even appeared to lose some of their armored vehicles to the other side. And in the regional capital Donetsk, pro-Russia gunmen took over the mayor's office. The BBC's David Stern is in Donetsk and has been watching the standoff.
Well, Marco, it was a fairly calm situation, but calm, I say in perhaps quotation marks, because it is occupied by men in ski masks with serious-looking weapons. They are on the first floor, but apparently they also have people on all floors of the office. They haven't so much seized the building as they have just occupied it. It's a small distinction to make, but people are allowed to go in and out of the building at will, at least if they work there. The city council is allowed to meet. But obviously, anytime that you have men with ski masks on the first floor, that's not a normal work day. And they have said that they are part of a group from Kharkiv. It's called Aplot, and they are a fight club. But they have come out in the recent months very much against the opposition that now is in power. Now, they have occupied the building, saying that they are demanding a referendum on the political status of the eastern regions. And they say they're going to stay there until this referendum is, you know, put on the schedule.
So these protesters, you call them a fight club? What does that mean? It doesn't sound very savory.
They're a group, as I say, I guess you should put fight club in quotation marks. They're boxers, very physically large, practiced fighters, and the ones that are in the mayor's office are very well armed. We saw a lot of weaponry there.
That's happening in the mayor's office. I'm kind of at pains to imagine what's going on outside the mayor's office and just like daily life in Donetsk. What's it like there?
Well, I look out on the street and there people are waiting for the buses and walking up and down, doing their shopping, going to work. This is an industrial part of the country. You have miners going into the mines or probably are already there now. But there is a definite tension and worry. I talk to people and everybody is, regardless on what side of the political divide they are extremely worried that this could end up being a conflict that either becomes even larger in Donetsk or, in fact, engulfs the entire region and the eastern part of Ukraine, if not in Ukraine altogether.
And this muscle, these fight club guys inside the mayor's office there in Donetsk, I mean, how representative are they of, you know, the average person in the streets of Donetsk?
Well, it's difficult to say. What I've found when I've been speaking to people is that although there is not a whole lot of sympathy with the idea of joining Russia, at the moment at least, there is a great deal of support for the idea of becoming more autonomous and also that they don't really trust the central government in Kiev. They find they're very suspicious of it. They think that these people are either usurpers or they don't represent their interests, and they think that whatever happens, it's better if they have more control over their own affairs.
The rhetoric coming from Kiev right now is pretty potent. The interim prime minister, Arseniy Yatsenyuk, is saying Moscow is exporting terrorism, that Russia is putting up a Berlin Wall. What's driving him to up the ante in what seems to be a pretty delicate situation?
Well, he's been saying that not necessarily those words, Berlin Wall and exporting terrorism. Yes, you're right. That's pretty incendiary. But they've been saying up until now that this is a Russian invasion, this is Russian aggression, and that this needs to be countered. And they're backed up by Western leaders. We've heard from President Obama. We've heard from British officials. We've heard from the head of NATO, who says that Russia is deeply engaged in what's going on here. And at the same time, they're saying that if there is going to be civil war, it will be because Russia has brought it to that point. Obviously, we need to say that Russia says they have absolutely no involvement here, that they are interested in letting the people of the East have their voice, and they say that this country needs a new constitution, and that it's the government in Kiev that's bringing them to civil war. But the situation is critical, and I think that the prime minister's remarks reflect the panic or the concern of what this ultimately could lead to.
So the headline seems to be increasing military activity on both sides, both with pro-Russian forces and Ukrainian government troops. Are we at a point, do you think, where you can say that one outnumbers the other or has an upper hand here?
It's difficult to say who has the upper hand. At the moment, the Ukrainian troops are being extremely careful because they say they don't want to create any unnecessary casualties. But at the same time, they are in a difficult position because they are constantly being surrounded by groups of civilians who are preventing them from moving or who have surrounded them in the towns where they've gone to. So it's a very fluid situation, as you can imagine. But there is a great deal of activity, and it seems that the situation is moving possibly further to a more direct confrontation. Even though we don't have necessarily full-out fighting and shots being fired, it needs to be said that it could happen at any moment.
The BBC's David Stern in Donetsk in eastern Ukraine. Thank you for your time, David.
Thank you, Marco.
So NATO's involved in talks over the crisis in Ukraine, but the Western Military Alliance is doing more than just talking. Today, NATO announced new deployments designed to deter Russia from making any aggressive moves. That includes more air and naval patrols around the region and measures to step up troop readiness on land. And since NATO includes several member countries that border Ukraine and Russia, this is pretty serious stuff. The World's Carol Hills is with me now to help us analyze all of this and really address some concern here in the U.S. about the mounting tension. Are we watching this in the U.S., Carol, so closely because there's actually some real fear that we could somehow go to war with Russia over this, or at the very least, maybe some old Cold War lines redrawn?
I think it might be the latter. I think for anyone of a certain age, which of course includes me, I mean, sort of living through a lot of the Cold War and remembering those stark lines and no information about the Soviet Union, no travel, and a sense that Russia, as it's constituted today, really still wants an influence in Eastern Europe. I remember when this crisis started about a month ago, it was like, really? Taking Crimea? It was such a sense of this just seems such a throwback and something I would have never expected.
It is a question being asked, though, and it does feel as if the soldiers on the war game board are there for something, and there are next moves in the offing. So if you pull back, what strikes you about this story?
Well, the biggest thing that strikes me about it is the sense of humiliation that Vladimir Putin keeps referring to. I just hadn't realized the degree to which many Russians feel a sense of sort of shame and anger over how things have rolled for Russia since the end of the Cold War. I guess I naively assumed that, yes, the Soviet Union fell apart, but hey, in its place, you can have a Russia that's been regrouped, maybe a strong economy, and still have a real force in the world. But all the rhetoric from Russia and from Putin has been about this sense of humiliation, the sense of being ignored, the sense of not mattering, and really trying to redress that and say, hey, we matter a lot, and this influence is important to us.
So, Carol, one of the many hats you wear here at The World is that you look at political cartoons around the world. Are there cartoons or kind of commentaries on what's happening right now, looking at, you know, Vladimir Putin and the stakes in all of this for Russia?
Absolutely. And just a ton coming from where you might expect Europe, both what I used to call Eastern Europe or Central Europe and Western Europe. And most of them are really about Putin flexing his muscles, sort of literally big muscles busting through the sleeves of his jacket, saying gas on each side. You know, Vladimir Putin in a swimsuit that has the hammer and sickle on a frozen lake and there's a hole and he's about to dive in, sort of diving into the Cold War. There's just a lot of that showing Putin really trying to restore what he thinks is his place in the world and his country's place in the world.
The World's Carol Hills, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
For those Ukrainians who identify more with the West than with Russia, there's an old Ukrainian folk song that's become a sort of anthem.
Мамко ж моя не лай мені, мамко ж моя не лай мені.
It's called Plena Kacha. The song is especially associated with those who lost their lives during the protests in Kiev's Independence Square or Maidan. And it means a great deal to Ukrainians like the BBC's Irina Taranyuk.
I knew this song for a number of years as something very mournful, very sad. I used to have a good cry about when I felt down. It is a lament. It's about a young soldier, young recruit going to fight in foreign wars and him having a dialogue with his mother, saying, "My dear mother, what will happen to me if I die in a foreign land?" And she tells him, "Well, my dearest, you will be buried by other people." It's really poignant and sad.
So what's the symbolism now and the connection of this song to the protesters who died in Kiev's Maidan?
Marco, you know, there is hardly anything in any folklore, in any sung tradition, anywhere in the world that is more sad, more lament-like than this song, Plena Kacha. And when dozens of people killed by snipers in Maidan on the 18th and 20th of February were buried and mourned in the mass funeral of the February the 21st, it was this song, Plena Kacha. It became known to the broader world. It became known to all Ukrainians because some of the Russian-speaking Ukrainians from the East never heard this song probably until the funerals, mass funeral. It acquired a life of its own, this song, and a new life for the 21st century.
There are parts of the song and the harmonies that sound almost religious, like Gregorian chanting. Is that part of the appeal now as well?
It is a particularly appropriate part of that song that appeals to the mood, the general mood of the country, because Ukraine is the country in mourning, and actually the country that didn't have the time to mourn its dead. Ukrainians call those people who died, who gave their lives for at Maidan, they call them Heavenly Hundred, because over 100 people died, killed by snipers in a ruthless and the most bloody page of Ukrainian history since obtaining independence in 1991. So this is, you know, something that we couldn't have foreseen even, that it is possible in our day and age, in a contemporary European country that we all believed Ukraine to be, that, you know, 100 people can be killed by snipers, by marksmen like that in cold blood. So that was the death knell of presidency by Yanukovych, but also it was a reawakening of Ukrainians as a nation because they said that the ultimate sacrifice by these people should not be forgotten. We are still lamenting our dead. Mm. We are still singing Plena Kacha po Tesini. And unfortunately, now my fear for this song is that it will be associated with the loss, with the dead of Maidan, rather than with a longer folklore tradition, that now this song will be predominantly associated with the Heavenly Hundred.
The BBC's Irina Taranyuk, thank you very much for your time.
Pleasure, Marco.
Сам не знаю, де погину.
Later on the show, the watering can that'll kill your plants and will get you wet, and other counterproductive designs on the world from PRI Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic, searching for runners who benefit from medical technology to run in the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon, and by TiVo, delivering cable TV and internet TV together in one searchable and unified viewing experience. Available at TiVo.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Most of us don't think about where we want to be buried. Not much, anyway. But the late American scholar Richard Nelson Fry had a very clear idea about his burial spot. He devoted his life to studying ancient Persia, today's Iran, and he wanted to be buried in Isfahan in central Iran. Here's Fry in 2007 speaking with The World's Katie Clark.
Isfahan is still the place of culture and craftsmanship of Iran. That's what Iran is all about, which is culture.
Fry died last month at age 94 here in Boston, but he's not buried in Isfahan. In fact, that's up in the air because some hardliners in Iran are against his burial there. Turaj Dariayi teaches Iranian history at the University of California, Irvine. So you were a friend of Richard Fry's. What was he like?
Yes, I did know him, but I should say that anyone who worked in the field of Iranian studies ended up knowing Richard Fry. He was actually a friend to all of us. And my meeting came about when I was just a graduate student, when he wrote me a note. And I was really honored. And it was really a warm letter. And when I got to meet him, he was even kinder and really a gentle soul, I would say.
So tell us a bit more about his passion for Iran. You took a trip to Iran with him. Maybe we can get an insight to his love for Iran through your description of that trip.
Sure. About 11 years ago, he was given an award in Tehran, and he showed up there, and I was there. And then after a couple of days, he wanted to go outside of the capital. And so we took a 10-day trip to the Kurdish area of Iran in the northwest, which was, of course, really memorable for me. I think you really get to know people when you travel with them. And, you know, although he was in his 80s, he was such an inquisitive guy. He had been through Iran many, many times. But anything that he hadn't seen, he would get really excited about and act almost like a little child in his excitement. And whoever he met, he would, you know, start speaking in Persian and say, "I am an American. I want to take a picture with you. I study Iranian studies." And, you know, we did this in several places that maybe it wasn't the best place to say you're an American. For example, we went to the paternal house of Ayatollah Khomeini to visit the house. And right as soon as we entered, he went to the guard and said, "I am an American. I would like to take a picture with you." And the guard, of course, was terrified.
Oh my gosh.
But Fry was so kind that he actually did end up taking a photo with him. And, you know, they actually hugged. And it was really nice.
Clearly, Fry loved Iran. Why is there opposition to him being buried in Isfahan?
I should say, I think the majority of the people I have talked to really acknowledge him and want him to be buried in Iran. This is his wish for a long time. I think it's really a small minority. And, you know, in any country, you get a group that usually is quite vocal and come into the news. And it's that minority now that in Iran have really done something, I think, quite shameful. They've gone in front of this tomb and, you know, they've had banners that we're not going to let this person be buried here. I think a lot of there's a push and pull within the government between the different sides or factions on what to do. It's become somewhat political, but I'm going to be doing an interview with the students at the University of Tehran. Actually, I'm going to say something about it. And the students in University of Tehran and other universities are putting program in honor of Richard Fry. He's really loved by the students. His books are translated into Persian. And so a lot of people who are interested in history know about him. Mm.
Can you just describe Isfahan for us? I mean, what is it about the city that makes these non-Iranians want this to be their final resting place? Why is it so seductive?
Yeah, I wish more people would get to go there, and I hope when relations get better, people do visit. It is indeed a magical city. When you go there, you feel you're transported to the 16th century. The city is exquisitely kept in terms of its artistic structure and the great square and the mosques and the bazaar. You're just transported to this very interesting place. And I think that's why Fry, although he lived more in Shiraz, he just thought Isfahan was really the place. And in Persian, we call this Isfahan Nisve Jahan, half of the world, in terms of its beauty and its culture.
Tiraj Darayi teaches Iranian history at UC Irvine. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
As you may know, matzah is a big part of the Passover celebration. But this flat, dry, unleavened bread, all right, crackers basically, they don't get a lot of love and respect. It was different in the former Soviet Union, where displays of religion were outlawed. Jews there went to great lengths for their matzah, as you can hear in this collection of stories prepared by producer Dina Prichip.
If you were Jewish, you definitely didn't have all the privileges of everybody else. I am Vitaly Paley. I was originally born in a little city called Gomel, which is in Belarus. And now I own three wonderful restaurants in Portland, Oregon. People feared for their safety if they were to practice religion, but they managed to retain their food traditions. And through food, they retained that religious practice.
My name is Slava Fromkin. And I was born in Smolensk region in Soviet Union. Passover, we never had a Seder per se. In Russia, it was more kind of like you participating in this by just having matzahs. And that's why it was important to have matzahs.
Matzah becomes embedded within Jewish identity. My name is Jeffrey Weidlinger, and I'm a professor of Judaic studies and history at the University of Michigan. In 1956, they cracked down a little bit on the synagogues and explicitly forbade the baking of matzah inside synagogues. And there were homes that every year kind of turned into makeshift bakeries around Passover.
In our area, it was a one home, and we would deliver the flour to the home. It was like a well-oiled machine. All the family members running and doing different things. But no matter what, in 1 hour you get in your matzahs. By some reason, everybody used pillowcases. And sticking this matzahs in the pillowcases, then we would bring it home, and we had a special suitcase.
The suitcase, yes. That suitcase stayed closed until the doors were closed in the house, and she would bring the suitcase in or open it up, and there would be this wad of matzah in there. Yeah, the matzah was hidden, well hidden from anybody else who could see it, for sure, yeah.
You have to understand, it was like a sense of secrecy around this. And it was feeling to some degree with some pride in your heart, you know. You're doing something secretly what the government doesn't want.
In a way, this heightened the importance of the holiday. I mean, the thing is, if they had just allowed the factories to bake matzah, people could have just gone to purchase matzah.
When we crossed the border into the free world, you wanted matzah, you openly bought it, and you ate it on the street. I mean, how cool is that? For the Jewish people, once we've traveled here, we could practice our religion and peace and harmony, and matzah is the symbol of it.
But then when you have plenty of freedom, and you have plenty of matzahs, and everything is plentiful, then the value is somewhat different, probably. When you have to work for this, you know, it changes the taste to some degree. To me, it was always a treat. I loved matzah.
Vitaly Paley, Slava Frumkin, and Jeffrey Weidlinger speaking with producer Dina Prichip. This is PRI Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman. Ahead, why a Harvard Business School professor studied Mumbai's Dabbawala lunch delivery system.
It created a puzzle in my mind. How can they pull this off? You know, so many people, semi-literate workforce, really low cost, extremely high quality, and they don't seem to be doing any of the things that we teach here.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, searching for runners who benefit from medical technology to run in the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon or Medtronic 10-Mile Run. Application and information available at medtronic.com/globalheroes.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. Ever since Osama bin Laden left his native Saudi Arabia for Afghanistan, Saudi authorities have worried about this scenario. Young Saudis who leave to fight a jihad become radicalized somewhere else and then return to wage war against their rulers back home. That's why a few years ago, the kingdom created a system of so-called terrorist rehab centers designed to re-educate the young Saudis when they come home. But the concern hasn't gone away. It's estimated that some 1,200 Saudi men have left their country to fight in Syria. Reporter Ben Gilbert visited one of the rehab centers and has this report.
The Prince Mohammed bin Nayef Counseling and Care Center is located on the dusty outskirts of the Saudi capital, Riyadh. Currently, it's housed in a walled compound that used to be a holiday resort. The compound is divided. One side is administrative and still looks like a resort with palm trees and pools. The other side looks more like a prison. Interior Ministry official Colonel Omar Zalal al-Khatani walks down a long hall. At the end, two guards sit next to the steel door that divides the two sides.
So that's the door between the administrative side and the
patient. Go see the other side.
The guards unlock the door to reveal what looks like a prison yard, but there are no guard towers, and the walls could easily be scaled. Colonel Khatani says the center is somewhere between a prison and freedom. The 14 men undergoing treatment here are referred to as beneficiaries, not prisoners or even patients.
But at the same time, they're watching. Sure. If they see anything wrong, you know, they could go back to prison. Yeah. This is a rehab center. It's like, you know, another word, it's a examining center. You know, they want to make sure that, you know, these people, you know, could live with a society.
In the yard, a half dozen plainclothes police officers, guards, greet us. Nearby, six of the current Saudi beneficiaries linger inside and at the door to a classroom. Their beards are long and bushy, and they wear the short tunic favored by puritanical Salafist Islamists. All appear to be in their 20s or 30s, and one of them sports brand new neon Nikes. They're waiting for their teacher to arrive. The teacher is a short, bespectacled, U.S.-trained criminal psychologist named Nasser al-Arifi. His lecture today is an example of the program's focus on using a mixture of Western therapy and Islamic teachings to cure the young men.
Today we're going to focus on how they control their anger. And this is very important for them. And, you know, we use just the psychology's theories beside what comes in Quran and also what the Prophet Muhammad says about controlling the anger.
The rehab center is named after the Saudi Interior Minister, Prince Mohammed bin Nayef, who has championed the rehabilitation approach to combat what the staff here calls extremist tendencies among some Saudis. More than 3,000 men have graduated from the rehab center since it first started in 2008. Their offenses vary widely. Some fought in Afghanistan or Iraq, or were plotting against the Saudi state or one of its allies. Some were basically picked up for hanging out with the wrong crowd, like Badr al-Azianzi. He's a tall, shy, and skinny 28-year-old Saudi man who speaks softly, but almost 2 years ago, he was arrested and imprisoned for his extremist tendencies. When I was arrested, I had ideas against my country, the government, and also non-Muslims, Badr says. I was also thinking about going for jihad. I had relationships with people who were suspicious, and so this worried the security agencies, and they arrested me. Badr says he was upset by what he saw the American military doing in Afghanistan and Iraq against his Muslim brothers. But when the police arrested him, he hadn't actually done anything wrong. He was just picking up his passport from a government office. I had bad thoughts and ideology, Badr says. I was arrested in advance to prevent me from doing anything wrong. But if I weren't caught at that time, maybe I'd be in Syria right now, or dead. Badr is one of the men who successfully completed the rehab program. He says the beneficiaries learn three key points. I've learned in this center that there are some conditions for jihad, he says. The first condition is that we should be under one flag, one leader. The second is that we should have permission from that leader. And third is that our parents must approve our going on jihad. I didn't have any of these three. In other words, Badr's impression was that holy war is okay just so long as it's approved by the Saudi king. This would seem to be good news for the United States since Saudi Arabia is an ally, but it does give some analysts pause. Saeed Wahas is one of the architects of the rehab program. I asked the professor of political science and medicine if drawing the line between good and bad jihad is enough to stop people who think they are fulfilling God's will.
Unfortunately, those people are going to interpret the verses of Quran according to the way they are thinking. For example, they would like to go directly to the paradise. You know, the life is very distressing. It's not easy. When I'm going just to die just 5 minutes through the process of death, and I'm going to be on the paradise, I will do it soon without any problems.
Money, a job, and family also help to convince the beneficiaries here that life can be good without jihad. As for Badr, he's been released and lives with his wife and four children. The government gave him $25,000 to open a shop. He says he'll never go back to jihad unless, of course, he can meet those three conditions for jihad that he learned at the rehab center. For The World, I'm Ben Gilbert.
When we think about young people swept up in a conflict somewhere, we tend to think about young men, but that doesn't mean girls are spared the trauma. On Monday, militants in Nigeria kidnapped at least 100 teenage girls from a school in the country's remote northeast. Residents suspect the Islamist militant group Boko Haram. One of the girls who managed to escape spoke with the BBC.
They took us through a town called Boa. Then one of their cars broke down, and they had to slow down. And then they transferred us to other vehicles. It was then that some of the girls in our truck decided to jump from the vehicle. I also decided to jump with some other girls. We ran into the bush and waited until daybreak before we went back home.
Now, these abductions come on the heels of a blast Monday at a busy transit station in Nigeria's capital, Abuja. More than 70 people were killed. Boko Haram is also thought to be behind that attack. Omoyele Shaware is a publisher of SaharaReporters.com, a website of citizen journalists. What are you hearing from your networks in Nigeria, Omoyele, about these abductions?
We've received a few texts, including one today saying that 50 parents showed up at the school today to see if they can find the kids. And the governor also said only 14 of the girls have been recovered so far. So there are conflicting reports. And we all know this abduction took place for several hours. Nothing came in terms of support for the girls. The abductors came at 9 p.m. and left at 3 a.m. As a matter of fact, they said they made several trips from the school.
It's got to be a shocking realization if you're a parent and one of these girls is your daughters at this school, that they just get abducted like that. Have you heard anything about reaction?
Well, the reaction has been, of course, condemnation and shock. Condemnation to the Nigerian military authorities who've always claimed that Boko Haram insurgency will be over by April, and it's now sounding like April Fool. The only girls who have so far returned home were the ones who braved the odds and jumped out of the trucks and came back home.
What don't we get when we talk about Boko Haram?
What people don't get is that Nigeria is lacking in leadership and resources to deal with this effectively. And the earlier the rest of the world understand this and come to the aid of the Nigerian people, the better for the world, because this is likely going to escalate into a regional crisis pretty soon. They're already making inroads in abducting and kidnapping in Cameroon, anyway. So
in Cameroon,
yes,
neighboring Cameroon. Yeah.
So this is going to become a regional problem pretty soon, because these guys are getting more and more emboldened.
Omoyele, you can no longer openly return to Nigeria because of the sort of reporting you and Sahara Reporters undertake. Explain that.
In the last 7 years, we started a citizen reporters platform. And what we decided to do was to just take reports directly from citizens across Nigeria. And some of this reporting that we've done have really, really unearthed a lot of information that otherwise were not known, including, you know, huge bank accounts, homes and their properties, private jets owned by the Nigerian elite and people in government. The Nigerian government can no longer tolerate, you know, our kind of reporting. So they place our names at the airport. And if we're to be found or arrested, you can imagine what will happen to us.
I'm curious, where do you think the Boko Haram story could take you and Sahara Reporters?
Well, you know, it once ended us a place in one of their videos where they actually threatened to bomb our offices in New York.
Boko Haram threatened
us? Yes,
this?
Yes. Boko Haram leadership last year did threaten us because they said we were just revealing too much of their secrets, because we rely on citizens. Some of the people working with them, some of their operatives do actually provide information sometimes. And of course, it puts us at risk with the Nigerian government and, of course, a non-state actor like Boko Haram. We don't know where it would take us. We're more concerned about where it would take Nigeria.
Omoyele Sowore is the publisher of SaharaReporters.com, a website of citizen journalists in Nigeria. Thank you very much, Omoyele. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Michael.
Remember Joseph Kony? He's the warlord in Uganda who gained global notoriety in a bad way when a video about him went viral a couple of years ago. Yes, I'm talking about Kony 2012. Well, Kony and his infamous Lord's Resistance Army, or LRA, are still out there, as is the group behind the video. Reporter Saul Gonzalez has this update on Kony 2012.
For 26 years, Kony has been kidnapping children into his rebel group, the LRA.
The video was produced by a little-known San Diego-based activist group called Invisible Children.
Our mission is very clear. The end of the LRA. That's what we do.
Its CEO and co-founder is Ben Kesey.
That's our day job, that's our night job, that's our weekend job. And we work on nothing else. You know, Invisible Children is not in Colombia or Burma or working on other issues of child soldiers. We've locked on to this comprehensive model on one issue. And that specificity, that clarity, and that kind of tenaciousness to see one thing finished is unique in the nonprofit world.
Invisible Children says Kony 2012 was a crucial step in that process, rallying global public opinion against the LRA. The video certainly did that, but it also sparked a backlash against Invisible Children itself. Critics from academics to ordinary people blasted the group as a bunch of self-promoting amateurs, like this woman on the web.
Why are they making it seem like Uganda is one big hellhole because of Kony? Because it's not. So this video isn't really giving you the correct information. So you should probably educate yourself.
Invisible Children's Ben Kesey says the attacks took their toll on their organization. That included the temporary mental breakdown of Kony 2012 director Jason Russell, who was arrested for screaming and running naked on the streets of San Diego. A video of that even wound up on TMZ.
We've come a long ways in our own maturity, and we're still young. We're still very young, but we were really young back then. But it was the hardest thing I've ever gone through personally.
Kesey says 2 years after the controversy, Invisible Children has a renewed focus on helping find Joseph Kony and his fighters.
Bonjour, comment ça va?
Pas trop mal.
Okay.
Je reviens d'une réunion.
From its offices in a converted industrial building, offices with the casual vibe of a tech startup, Invisible Children staff runs projects in Congo, the Central African Republic, and South Sudan. They're all places where Kony's forces, long driven from Uganda, are thought to be hiding.
Joseph Kony and the LRA are far more desperate than they have ever been in their history.
Sean Poole is in charge of a bunch of programs, like dropping leaflets from planes in hopes of convincing LRA fighters to defect, and giving high-frequency radios to remote villages so people can report the LRA's movements and threats. And Poole says Invisible Children is happy to work with militaries in the region, as long as it helps stop Kony and the LRA.
Invisible Children does not claim to be neutral. You know, the entire international community has said the LRA is a bad thing. They have no popular support. No communities have come behind what they're doing. We are rooting for the end of the LRA.
But Invisible Children still has its critics, people who don't believe the group's activities on the ground in Africa are really helping matters.
What they ended up doing was complicating the search and, in fact, delaying his capture or elimination.
J. Peter Pham is the director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council, a research and policy institute. He's monitored Invisible Children for years. Pham says Invisible Children may have learned something from its original mistakes, but clearly not enough. And he says Joseph Kony, as bad as he is a threat of the past.
In the Central African Republic, where Kony is likely hidden, we've got massive atrocities going on between the Christian and Muslim communities. In South Sudan, another area that Kony moves in, we've got a civil war going on that has taken, since December, at least 10,000 lives. So if one is really interested altruistically in the welfare of these people, one should probably ask Africans themselves what are the biggest threats to their security, their livelihoods, and that they would like to see dealt with. And I highly doubt that very many people in this region would identify Joseph Kony as that priority.
But Invisible Children says the crimes Joseph Kony and his followers are accused of do continue, and getting rid of him and the LRA would go a long way towards solving those other regional problems.
There is no war without soldiers. And this year, we are asking you to join us in the countdown to Zero LRA.
For the World, I'm Saul Gonzalez in San Diego.
This is The World on PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. You know what a fork looks like and how to use it, right? A great blend of form and function, actually, at least until Caterina Comprani gets a hold of one. For this week's Sideways Glance, The World's Clark Boyd does a double take at some of Comprani's versions of everyday objects.
Uncomfortable. It's a word I've heard a lot while reporting on the ongoing Greek economic crisis during the past few years. People who once had good jobs, houses, a level of comfort, suddenly find it's all vanished. Athens-based architect Caterina Comprani's no exception.
Well, the problem is getting worse, and here in Athens and in Greece in general, architecture is not going very well. I also tried to do other stuff.
And what Comprani's done is tap into her own discomfort. A few years ago, she started thinking of everyday objects and how they might be reimagined.
The first sketch that I did, it was a toilet that was, the floor of the toilet was elevated 2 meters approximately from the floor. So you have to use a ladder to go to the toilet. And I thought, that's uncomfortable.
Indeed. And then
another idea popped into my mind, which was a closet that its doors would open inwards. It's just a box. Yeah, even if you put something in it, you cannot take it out very easily.
Comprani transferred her sketches to her computer and started doing 3D mock-ups of the objects. There's an umbrella made of cement, a beautiful bowl with a hole in the bottom, and yellow rain boots without the toes.
I try for the objects to be a bit usable. I don't want them to be completely useless. So, I mean, but you can use them, but you have to try a lot.
She calls the set of designs the uncomfortable. There are many variations on that classic, the fork. Comprani's got versions with hinged tines. There's another with tines 3 inches thick. They're forks, but they're not.
We all know what a fork does and what a spoon does and, you know, all these everyday objects around us. So you have an expectation of that object to do something, and what I design, it doesn't. It's very close to that, but it's a bit different.
For my part, I started out by laughing at Comprani's designs, and then, after a couple of minutes, I got a bit annoyed.
Many people get angry. I don't know why. They say, I'm so angry seeing this.
Comprani thinks it's because people start thinking about what it would be like to try to use her uncomfortable objects. Take Comprani's design for a pretty blue watering can. She's turned the spout backwards so that if you tried to pour the water out, it would instead pour right back into the can.
It's not even in the guidelines that I have for myself for uncomfortable. I think it's completely useless. It doesn't do anything. But it's very symbolic.
Symbolic, she says, of life in Greece these days. It's moved beyond the uncomfortable, says Comprani, and straight into the surreal. And what would be even more surreal, she says, is if one day the Greek economy actually improved and she had enough money to build real versions of her computer-designed creations. I'd be the first in line for those toeless yellow rain boots. They'd actually go quite well with that watering can that doesn't actually water. Kind of an official sideways glance uniform. For The World, I'm Clark Boyd.
Uncomfortable is also pretty funny, until it's not. We have a slideshow featuring some of Caterina Comprani's designs at PRI.org. Finally today, have you seen the movie from India called The Lunchbox? Great story. I strongly recommend it. It all turns around the culture of dabbawalas. These are guys who deliver hot lunches to people at work all over Mumbai. But in the film, one lunch keeps getting delivered to the wrong man. The woman making the meal confronts the dabbawala. Impossible, says the dabbawala. We never make a mistake. Even Harvard has studied us, he says. Well, Stefan Tomke is a professor at the Harvard Business School who studied the dabbawalas.
A dabba is the actual lunchbox, and Avala is the person who handles the box.
Right.
That's why Dabavala.
So the background to this, the system goes back to the 19th century, I read. Why did it start?
It started out sort of with a basic need, and that is people wanted to have home-cooked food, and they wanted to have it delivered to their work. And the system, as I said, it's over 100 years old, and it basically kind of grew. And today, when you look at it, they have something like 250,000 transactions per day. Wow. With about 5,000 people essentially running around and using bicycles and carts all over the city of Mumbai. And I don't know if you've been to Mumbai, but, you know, Mumbai is, to put it mildly, a very, very chaotic place. So it's quite amazing that they pull all this off, make basically no mistake. And what's even interesting is they do it at extremely low cost.
Yeah, how much do they charge their customers?
It varies. It depends on where you live, you know, but today, you know, sort of the typical customer would pay somewhere between 400 to 500 Indian rupees. A dollar is about, you know, 60 to 65 rupees or so. So this is really low cost.
And they pay that per month? I mean,
per month, yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And no documents, no kind of records these Dabawalas keep to know which lunchbox goes to whom? I mean,
it's in their heads.
No way.
Yes. I had the same reaction when I first saw this. You know, I've been going to India for nearly 28 years now. So I used to see these guys on the street all the time, and I never really thought much of it until one final day. It was in 2008. I was in a hotel room and I picked up a leaflet, and the leaflet sort of described this sort of in a few paragraphs. And it created a puzzle in my mind, because how can they pull this off? You know, so many people, semi-literate workforce, really low cost, extremely high quality, and they don't seem to be doing any of the things that we teach.
Okay, so what is their secret? What did you find out? How do they pull this off with such great efficiency?
The secret is the system.
What does that mean?
Let me give you an example. The system works because of the way the railway system is structured. It sort of helps them in sort of an unexpected way. It synchronizes the system. Because in Mumbai, the railway system is one of the few things that actually always runs on time. It forces the entire organization to run according to a rhythm.
Mm. Well, so the dependency on the transportation kind of keeps everybody honest.
Exactly. So it's the rhythm and the synchronization that the railway system gives you in addition to the transportation. So there are a lot of things like that. The labeling is another great story. They have very little information on the boxes. For example, there's no return address. But these different boxes have to go back to the person who gave them to you.
How do they know where to take them?
It's in their heads. So it comes back to the information that's on there. It gets them back to the last distribution point. And then from the last distribution point, it's all about memory. And they bring it back.
In the movie The Lunchbox, all these Dabawalas seem to be almost identical. They're all in white. They all have these little white caps. Like,
Gandhi cap.
It's a Gandhi cap.
Yes, yes.
So who are these guys?
Most of them are coming from a particular region, sort of India. That's where they're typically recruited. Interesting. They're not employees. They're all partners. When you're joining the Dabawalas, you actually have to buy yourself into it. You have to be, a shareholder. And you basically participate sort of in the profits that come out of it, and they make a decent living.
Stefan Tomke, he's a professor at the Harvard Business School, where he did a case study of the Dabawala system in Mumbai. Thanks for coming in, Stefan.
Oh, no, thank you for having me. Mera dil bhi kitna pagal hai, ye pyar to tumse karta hai.
Now to find a way to get a hot homemade Indian lunch delivered here. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH, I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for tuning in.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the Rita Allen Foundation, investing in transformative ideas in their earliest stages to leverage their growth and promote breakthrough solutions to significant problems, ritaallen.org, by the PRI New Voices Fund. Donors include Maureen and Michael Rutgers and the Sarah and Evan Williams Foundation. The PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Gruber Family Foundation, Marguerite Steed Hoffman, Ken and Lucy Lehman, and the Robbins Kaplan Miller Cerisi Foundation. By the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, GatesFoundation.org. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, MacFound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.